These people can pursue higher education if that's their wish, trades, vocational training, industrial training, and jobs, finally. Because you can have all the education that you can get and not have jobs and not be able to bring home bread and butter. You have nothing. You know, that sounds like words out of a book that I read. If you have all the education you need and have not a job, you have nothing. So we must, I think, work towards those goals, working first of all for number one, ourselves, because we make the population of the native people, each one of us who are one. And I think the number two is that we must take care of our immediate families. Some of us who are raising families must take care of those families. That's important. The other is we must look after our interests in our village corporations and the regional corporations. That's real important. Because what we do, as was previously mentioned by John Borbidge earlier, in educating our shareholders, I think it is real significant. We must do a better job of doing it. I could speak on forever on the topic of education because it's one of the things that is in my heart, and I would like to see everyone affluent in the Western culture as much as possible, because that's the world in which we're going to compete for a long, long time. And better we are knowledgeable in the ways of the Western world, Western European culture, the better off we're going to be, regardless of where we were 100 years ago. It's here to stay. Just look at the way the education is going in rural Alaska today. You don't have to look very far. You will see the direction of that education going into the urban type life. The television, the media, you know, the newspapers, the kinds of things, the textbooks. We can't dictate the kinds of textbooks that are out there. The school boards do that, and the school boards hire a superintendent. The superintendent gets these things and hires a curriculum director and all the rest of it, which pushes what for our young people? Let me tell you, from this person's standpoint, they push the glory and the glamour of the urban life. So where is most of Alaska Natives today living? Here in Anchorage. Look around you. Nearly 16,000 Alaska Native people live here in Anchorage. Give or take a few. That's a lot of Alaska Native people living in one community. Why are they here? That's because of the kind of education we have been giving them in the past. Because the jobs are here. The opportunities are here. We better get busy with our regional corporations and our village corporations and create some jobs where these people live. If we don't, we're going to lose the villages. I could tell you what we're trying to do at St. George. We're trying to establish the bottom fish industry, and I hope we're successful to keep our people there. But we must invest elsewhere, because not everyone is a seagoing person. There are some land lovers, and we'll always have those kind of people too. And we must take care of them. Besides, more than half of our shareholders don't live out there on the village. They live here on the mainland. So we have a responsibility. And I'm a board member of the Village Corporation, and that's why I'm concerned. I could be doing other things, but I think I'm doing the kinds of things I love to do and which I really have been involved with you all, if I may use a southern term here, from the very beginning, and that is to help the rural people, our native people. And I'm glad to this day, after all these years, I am involved in a village corporation. And I will, as long as I can survive if you know what I mean. Some of you know what I mean. If I can survive the political arena of the village corporation and the board set up and the way these things operate, I'll stay. But if not, fortunately for me, I do have credentials that I can use elsewhere. But I am doing what I most love to do, and that is to help our native people. But we're here to stay. So let's again remind ourselves in this great effort of Alaska Native Review Commission and the Native aspirations. What is it we most want out of this whole thing? I think it's self-respect, number one, for everybody. Not just a Native person, non-Natives as well. Self-respect, but mainly for the Native person. Equality of treatment. Equality of treatment. I think that's very important to all of us. Let's be treated equal, not regardless of where we go. I don't know whether I should mention this, but I got a phone call the other day. I've had forgotten 3 years ago, John, that I had applied for a job with the state in the State Department of Education. I was told on the phone the other day, I won't tell you who told me, I do have spies in Juneau, that I was the highest qualified person for that job that was open, had the best credentials, but I wasn't hired. And the people wanted to know why. Did I ever pursue it? Well, I didn't know I was the highest qualified. I thought I'd like to live in Juneau, close to my colleague here. And you know, it's a capital city of our state, and be close to the governor and all those good stuff. My wife is from Juneau, by the way. So I thought that'd be a good idea. But you know, I think there's something wrong, I want to suggest. When a Native person applies for a job, I think there are some things that are wrong. Still today, even after, I don't know how long ANB has been in existence, I think there are still some things that are wrong with the way our people are treated. And I think we ought to do a lot to correct those. We're far from arriving. We've got a long ways to go, and I'm running out of time, and I could go on, I suppose. But I want to thank you for listening, and commend very much those people who are conducting this review commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lekanoff. Mr. Hope, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the commission for undertaking this task. I think it is provident. I think that sometimes in the Indian or Native world, some things that we didn't plan bear better results than those things that we planned for ourselves. I think as a result of your hearings, probably some information will get out that may be helpful for our future. And I'd like to express my personal thanks for your efforts. I had no direct role because I was a government employee during the formation of this. However, I was involved in the first statewide movement of Alaska Natives, the group that Al Ketzler mentioned. The Association of American Indian Affairs sponsored a statewide gathering in 1964 in Fairbanks, in which all the Native organizations then in existence in the state of Alaska were invited to a statewide conference. I was a grand president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, and fortunately we had our own budget that allowed them to pay my way to that conference. It was the forerunner of the AFN. During the AFN, I missed the first meeting, the 1966 meeting, but I haven't missed a meeting since 1967, and I've been the parliamentarian ever since that time. It was very important that a divergent group of people, such as the Aleuts, like Mr. Lekanoff mentioned, and Athabascans, Thlinkets, Haidas, and Tsimshians, perceive that things are being conducted in a fair and impartial manner, and I try to do that. Mr. Nottie also prevailed upon me when he was president to look at the Constitution. He said there was some need to revise it, and he made me the chairman of that group, and I participated extensively then. Mr. Jackson, of course, was highly involved. Barry Jackson was the attorney at that time. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that the oversight that you're having, and I consider it sort of an oversight hearing, would have been very beneficial had Congress done the same thing. Had Congress, as part of ANCSA, mandated oversights of the results of that act, perhaps on a 3-year period or a 5-year period, to review what transpired as a result of the act, or what didn't happen that was supposed to happen as a result of that act. I think a lot of mischief perhaps would not have occurred, or mischief would have been reduced, had Congress mandated a review of the progress of the claims. The Secretary is supposed to give a report to Congress on an annual basis. I have the feeling that he doesn't do what I think is required. I think the Secretary is required to report on the progress and all those impediments that are inspired either by agencies or by conservation groups. Anything that might impede the progress of the act should be a responsibility of the Secretary. He has mandated a report. I don't know what he reports on. If he does report, in fact, what is happening, maybe nobody reads it. But I don't see any benefits from the annual report. And now we're looking forward to the 1985 report, which is the same section of the act which requires that he give an annual report. So I think this is a substitute for that, although we're quite far into the ball game and we can't make any mid-course corrections at this stage. In some cases, maybe the target is long past gone. But I think there will be some benefits to us as a Native community. I think it's very good that you break these down into the categories that you have done, the aspirations. We're very fortunate to have the people who were involved in formatting and trying to influence Congress. After all, it was a congressional settlement. People who were trying to influence Congress, I think by and large they were successful. I think that the only standard they had to measure against was the reservation system, and there was a very strong feeling in the Native community against that type of a settlement. And so we ended up with the settlement that Congress passed. It differs a great deal from judicial settlements. I think the Native people may have been influenced by the Thicket and Hyda suit that was initiated by a statement made by Peter Simpson that's in this. Peter Simpson was a Simpson, and he came from Old Metlakatla. He talked to Mr. William Paul Sr., Mr. Fred Paul's father, and he planted the seed of the suit against the United States government in 1925. Mr. Paul thought that perhaps the time was not the right time because we had just attained citizenship and our greatest desire was to become very good citizens, and he thought it was not the right time to initiate a suit. The ANB finally, in their 1929 convention in Haines, passed a resolution directing its officers to pursue a settlement of the lands that were taken. That resulted in the Jurisdictional Act being passed in 1935, which allowed the Thicket and Hyda tribes to file a suit in the Court of Claims against the United States government. In 1940, there was a meeting in Wrangell. In 1941, Mr. Fred Paul, Mr. William Paul Jr., and Mr. Henry Roden were hired by the Thicket and Hyda people to pursue that land claims effort. In 1959, a judgment was awarded to the Thicket and Hyda. In 1968, they got the money. So I think using that as their only measure, the Native leadership thought that's a long time to wait. between the time you start a land claims effort in the courts and the time you see the results. The legislative thing was very, very new, and of course, being legislative, it is political, and a settlement of that nature must be an instrument of compromise. You don't get all the things you want in a legislative settlement, but I think by and large, a settlement was a good settlement. However, I think the shortcomings that finally developed, where everyone thought because Congress passed an act, everything would happen in a very timely manner. In fact, Congress said it would do it in a timely fashion without any delays. I think the success of the corporations, if they had received their money and the land in a timely fashion simultaneously, I think that probably would have enhanced the chance for success. However, as some of the witnesses have indicated, some lands have not been conveyed to this date. I'm not sure what percentage of land has been conveyed, but from 1971 to 1984 is a long, long time. Some of the monies that were appropriated by Congress have long since gone. When you don't have these things happening in a timely fashion, you can almost guarantee that failure will result. There are some people now, because of 1991, attaching tribal sovereignty. See, Alaska conducted a survey of its shareholders quite some time back to get some reactions on various aspects of the corporation itself and the act. And there are a lot of people who understand the act, who have some relationship to their heritage. You have a close affinity between being a shareholder and their heritage. And I believe, however, there is no such attachment, that Congress created separate instruments. They created private corporations on the village level, on the regional level, and on the group level. And there is no direct attachment to the tribes as such. We share common constituents in many cases. However, they are separate instruments, and the only attachment that I see is the possibility of a conveyance of some of the land to the tribal counterparts. However, there appear to be many, many legal impediments to such a proposal. However, Congress, having plenary authority, as we hear they have, has the ability to do those kind of things. They have the complete control over the affairs of the Indian peoples, and that includes Alaska Natives of the United States. Very, very difficult and complex thing. However, reading your report and reviewing what you have done up to this point, I think that you've painted a pretty clear picture of what the Native community expected, perhaps what Congress shared in their expectations, but the things that have happened since that time have not happened as the authors may have expected. In reviewing these types of things, I think we're all a lot smarter at this present stage than we were way back then. Mr. Fred Paul and myself, I guess, predate the efforts of the land claims. And in those days, you had only a judicial settlement. And Congress at one point, I think in 1945 or thereabouts, the National Congress of American Indians came to Alaska, and they asked the Alaska Native Brotherhood membership to join with them, and they became, you know, our guide as to how land claims were treated. And right about that time, Congress had expressed the fact that they would no longer pass jurisdictional acts. As I understand judicial settlements usually just settle for the lands that you lost, and you have to prove you own the land and then a value is placed on them and you get a cash compensation. You don't ever receive land as part of the settlement. You usually just receive cash. So when you look at the land claims and see that there was a land settlement as well as a cash settlement, I think the option was a very good option for the framers of the legislation. Whether the other portions of the act should be changed to reflect what actually happened, I guess is something that could or should be pursued, and that is things should not be triggered until you get the land, until you get the total package. The 20-year thing, I think, has been taken care of in Anilka. The stock alienation thing, of course, has been addressed. No one has a complete answer to that, and I think within the Native community, we're still addressing that ourselves. As far as some regions are concerned, the 1991 is too far away. Not very many regions, but some of them are expressing that maybe they'd like to have that happen a lot sooner. The majority, however, are a little bit apprehensive of 1991, not knowing what effect that might have on them. Again, Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to be a participant in the conference. I'll be looking forward to the next session, which I think addresses what's happening today with the corporations and how can we do it better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hope. I wonder, Anne, if you would like to make any further comments at this time in light of what has been said since you presented your paper this morning.
Notably struck by Don Wright's statement that what I was reading in the testimony, that knowing the limitations, I recognized the limitations of that document, but I was basically, once I got into it, accepting that as reflective of Native views or of the views of those people. And if I heard him correctly, he was saying that often those did not always match how people were constrained and weren't able to say what they really wanted. That was an impressive statement to my mind. I'd be interested if other people had more. I mean, that's a very difficult subject to talk about, but that was probably, in what's been said so far, one of the most important things. If part of what we're doing, again, we're not trying to dig up corpses, but if part of what we're trying to do is see what were the things that people really did want out of the act. And often, again, I recognize that some people couldn't come, some people didn't know that the hearings were taking place, but I kind of figured that those that came were free to say their mind. And on some level, given they were talking, it was a political, they weren't always free to say their own mind. And that I think that's an important thing to have come out of what we've said, what's been said this morning.
Important to explore.
Well, I'll leave that to those. I won't say that.
Is there anyone else who'd like to make a contribution at this stage? Martha Dementiev?
I don't know how I found myself among the leaders. I've never been a leader, but I was always with the people. I was following the leaders, listening and trying to learn. And more than 10 years later, I'm still listening and trying to learn. A few of the things, one thing I wanted to say about your report, it was very good, I think. Many people testified on different things, and I'd like it to be understood that when our people talk, if they hear somebody mention something, or several people mention something, they don't mention it again. They'll hit it from another angle. So I think that we must understand that these 5 points that you brought up are all connected, even though most of the people spoke from a different angle. I've heard people talking today about education, and that's my special interest. I think that there was something being said about education before the land claims, and the cry that I heard was, we don't know, we don't understand what's going on. And I think we were asking for time to be educated before all this new change came about, as well as educating our young people in the future. And I don't think that part has been spoken about or understood. I've also heard self-determination mentioned. To me, self-determination implies a freedom to seek your own destiny, to be independent and responsible for oneself. In the old Native culture, before there were anybody but Natives in Alaska, we had an educational system that was completely successful. Everyone had to learn to wrest a living from the environment and to be responsible for themselves and their family. I would say that Native people had more self-determination before contact and had created a good, workable society. Since contact, Natives have had a hard time participating in an alien society and had almost no self-determination. All his knowledge was scorned, his language, land, religion, education system, and everything were slowly undermined. By 1971, hardly anyone would have described Alaskan Natives as having self-determination. By 1971, a few Natives had enough of the white man's schooling to work through the invader system to seek self-determination for their people. The regional corporations have money and land and resources. Theoretically, they can use these resources for the good of their people. The people vote for their leaders, then the leaders decide what is best for all shareholders. If you happen to agree with the leaders about how to invest money or develop land, use your vote, or in any way influence their decisions, you have self-determination. However, one important thing is missing. Not everyone is sufficiently educated in the white man's bureaucratic, political, economic system to participate in his own behalf. Because the system is foreign to most Natives and education is lacking, we now have people with less self-determination than before contact, but just a little more than before ANCSA. Congress has delegated its powers. The nonprofit corporations now run the social programs like health and welfare. These programs have become more in tune with Natives' needs. And the problems, the needs of our people in my village are handled by Native people in a kindlier and better way than they used to be. We do not have absolute cultural freedom. Our language is not used. Compulsory schooling interferes with learning the old culture, religion, and subsistence activities. We are forced by law to live in a corporate world or lose access to our own resources or share in them. We do not have community autonomy because we must organize as second-class cities or some form of government, not our own, in order to share the wealth. The Land Claims Act was a compromise. We had to accept that or nothing. It is better than nothing because we do own land and money. If we define self-determination as having control over land and money, as a group and for the material wealth of the group, then we do have more self-determination. I think we really won't have complete self-determination ever, any more than any other American has. So all I can talk about is degree of self-determination. I feel that we will have more self-determination if we take control of our education. If our schools can teach our people to participate in the new ways like voting and so forth, if we can understand federal and state politics and take political action, if we can understand the economy, stocks, bonds, corporations, subsistence laws, and so forth, then we need the opportunity to do what we learned, start businesses, get good career jobs, make a good living. Finally, we have to have a choice. Since subsistence is highly valued, we must preserve that way of life for those who chose it. Many of us live outside of the law of the land because we're forced to. We get our fish and game when we need it, despite the law. Many laws help us, but we should decide what is helpful. A lot of the people thought that we would have the fish and game, at least, that we needed. We never expected things to happen like happened in our village a couple of years ago, where an 86-year-old grandmother was got on a fishing violation. Things like that they just can't happen. We have to say, we have to have access to the fish and game on our land. Looking at the big picture, I would say that as a group, we natives have some self-determination in the white man's world, but we had more in the old culture. Also, as individuals, we don't have much self-determination because we have not been educated to participate in the new order of things. We need to increase our degree of self-determination, and that will be a continual effort. It wasn't our choice, the time limit. We were forced to have this ANCSA so quickly. Somebody said they wore 12 hats at one time, and that's true. We had to hurry up and get it over with or get nothing, and that was for the benefit of the state and the oil companies. It wasn't up to us to say the time limit on it. And I think that if anybody else is looking for a land claim settlement, there should be something, a time to educate to that system before the new system comes into effect. I was sorry to hear a note of sadness in someone who said that the village people do not understand the leaders. That's true, but we had a lot of trust in our leaders. And it was sad for those of us who couldn't understand to push the young people out there and make them work for us. And it was opposite of the old way where the elders would work for the young. I hope that the young leaders of today don't feel that we didn't appreciate what they did. Another thing I heard today was something about if there wasn't a settlement, there would have been bloodshed. I feel that there is bloodshed. It's very seldom directed towards the intruder. Most often, it's directed towards ourselves. That's all.
Thank you, Mrs. Dementiev. Well, we have to give the hall up in about 20 or 25 minutes. It may be that unless someone else wants to make a contribution now, we might discuss what we will do tomorrow. Lily McGarvey told me she wanted to speak tomorrow morning. She had to be away this afternoon, but she will be back then. And perhaps tomorrow morning I could call on Ralph Perdue and Roy Ewan and Ruby John and Paul Tiolana and Mr. Alfred Starr to make whatever contributions you think appropriate. And maybe we could, maybe I could ask some questions tomorrow, and I'll just mention some of the questions in my mind. And I'm not suggesting anybody has to feel obliged to answer them, but there's some questions that came up while I was listening to what you all had to say. My impression is that you all thought that that Ann Reardon, in her paper, had set out fairly the objectives that Alaska Natives and their leaders were trying to achieve in ANCSA. That is, what were their aspirations? And she set out five main goals that they had. And my impression is that most of you agreed with her summary. But perhaps we might discuss that tomorrow, and you might consider whether Anne's paper was in fact complete or not. You might also let me know whether you what you think of Don Wright's suggestion that to some extent people did not discuss certain things that that they were led to believe would injure their case, would hurt their case. I would particularly like to know whether you think there's that whether you agree with that point. We're looking back to the late 60s and early 70s to see what the goals of Native people were. Maybe you could tell me tomorrow how you think Native people feel today. How do Alaska Natives feel today? What are their expectations? That is, are their goals and expectations different today from what they were back in the late 60s and early 70s? Have their goals changed in the 12 years that have gone by? Are the things they discussed in the congressional hearings in the late 60s still as important to them today? And I wonder also if you might think of answering this question without, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight, and I think everybody has paid tribute to the work that was done in achieving ANCSA. As more than one of you have said, it was inevitably a compromise. As Mr. Hope said, it's a legislative settlement, not a judicial settlement, and there have to be compromises. And it was the best that could be obtained at the time. That, I think, is the view that has been expressed. Well, based on what we know now, with the advantage of hindsight, what other measures, what other things might have been sought, what other things might it have been wise to pursue at the time? That for one reason or another were not pursued. I'm not talking about acreage. I'm not saying, well, do you think you could have gotten 100 million acres instead of 44 million? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the structures. There's one other thing that that interests me about all this. Coming to Alaska today, there is much talk about IRAs and sovereignty. There was little talk of IRAs and sovereignty back in 1971. And Mr. Hope said, I think others said, that Alaska Natives rejected the whole idea of the reservation system at the time. Would anybody care to reflect tomorrow to talk about why the reservation system was rejected out of hand, why the IRAs were not in part of the discussion at the time, and why do you think that they are now being discussed? Does that indicate that the goals of Alaska Natives have changed since 1971, or are they simply pursuing the same goals through different means or different mechanisms? Well, I wonder, Rosita and Chuck, whether you have any questions you'd like to raise now that we might address tomorrow. There's a microphone there if you want to pass it down.
Mr. Chairman, I think that you have outlined at least the most specific questions that I had noted from the testimony given by John Borbridge, Don Wright, Fred Paul, and John Hope, and Harry Carter. And you do suggest that with hindsight that we have a lot more going for us. Tomorrow, I would hope that I could persuade, and we could persuade John Borbridge to perhaps expand on his statement where he says that sovereignty was not an ANCSA issue. He does suggest that there were laws and there were judicial decisions that protected that concept. Don Wright, in his testimony, suggests that, and as you had pointed out, that Native leaders were instructed not to talk about sovereignty. And then Fred Paul points out perhaps one of the reasons why IRAs were rejected, and that was the problem that IRA corporations and councils had experienced with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, primarily through the Salmon Cannery experience. And John Hope, who at the time was with the Bureau, as I understand, suggests that IRA and there was no direct relationship at all between, or no direct attachment with IRAs and corporations. And I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more about that from his perspective, working as the tribal operations person for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I think Harry Carter also points out maybe a part of the problem was that in the settlement that there was just really no time, as I think he says, to consult with the people. And perhaps there was, you know, that mechanism wasn't in place. And I think tomorrow, I mean, that's something I would like to pursue.
Well, thank you for those observations. Maybe then we could reconvene at 9 o'clock tomorrow, or very soon after 9 o'clock, and consider some of these questions and ask those of you who still haven't spoken to. Feel free to speak, and we'll ask Lily McGarvey to start off tomorrow. And David Case, who is the special counsel to the commission, he is a lawyer who teaches at Fairbanks. He will be joining us, and I think that's only fair. And Fred Paul, you have your own lawyer. It's only right that the commission should have its lawyer, and we'll open up the discussion a little more tomorrow. I just want to thank you all. I learned a great deal, and I hope you did. And I think that it's perhaps a good idea to conclude this opening session now while we're still fresh, and they'll be setting up the tables for bingo tonight, and I'm sure if you want to come in and buy a card, you're welcome. But we'll adjourn then until 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mr. Chairman, is that a rumor that 10% of the winnings go to the commission?
I wish it were true.
I'm trying to write much of something. I'm going to say goodbye.